Welcome to Go Ask Ally, a production of Shondaland Audio in partnership with iHeartRadio. Hi, I'm Ally Wentworth, and you're listening to Go Ask Ally, where this season I'm asking the question, how do you grow a teenager in a pandemic? Today, I'm going to be talking about mental health versus mental illness in teens. It is incredibly relevant today. I know so many people who are struggling and so many teens that are struggling. I actually picked up a newspaper today and saw that, you know, one of these 6 degrees of friends' daughter killed herself. And I can't help but wonder, was she suffering from depression anyway? And did she feel during this pandemic just not hopeful at all? So, It's good timing that Jean Blake is here to kind of tell us the difference between mental health and mental illness and how we look for signs and how do we chart this very uncharted territory of a pandemic and teens that are dealing with a monstrous amount of things emotionally. So my guest today, I'm going to give your credits right off the top. Jean Blake, leadership communication coach, author, award-winning science and medical TV journalist and news anchor and founder of Blake Works. And I have to tell you, Jean, I found you because I was doing some reading about teens and I came upon this article and you had so many great quotes in it. I circled your name and then I did what my teens do all the time, which is try to Instagram you, try to figure out who you were, Google you. And so I found you and I'm so happy you're here because there's so many things that you can speak to. But today I do want to talk to you about, first of all, the difference between mental health and mental illness. So let's just start with the basics.
Okay. So mental health, good solid mental health is what we all need to thrive and to be resilient and deal now, particularly in a world that is so incredibly uncertain. Mental illness is when something goes awry and we need to go to professionals for help and get back on track. And we're fortunate in this country that we have brilliant people. I also served on the board at McLean Hospital, which is Harvard's largest mental health facility. So we are blessed in this country to have access to that when something goes awry. And yeah, when parents or the other adults in kids' lives identify it and know when to reach out for that.
And I'm wondering, in a pandemic, it has to be more difficult. I mean, certainly you can find the people, but it's more difficult to get treatment. And if certainly in hardcore cases, to actually be committed to a place like McLean or Silver Hill or wherever. Are you finding that to be true?
Well, we knew that there was a veritable tsunami of mental health challenges coming down the road early on in the pandemic. And of course, there will be a billion studies done on every population and how they're navigating through this. So we don't have the real data yet, but there have been some early studies that point to how challenging this is, and in particular for teens. One out of China and a Gallup poll in May conducted with parents of children who are school-aged, it was a percentage that was like 35 or in that range, it's easy enough to Google, of parents who said that they were seeing declining mental health in their own children as a result of the pandemic. So we knew that there was this, as I said, this tsunami of challenges that were coming down the line. It was hard already to access mental health. There's yeah, just a dearth of providers, and there are many reasons for that. But we do know, the president of McLean Hospital told me that they have just seen a very big increase in the demand and the request for mental health. But the good news is telehealth has been put on fast forward, and McLean and other wonderful places are now providing that, as are hospitals for general care. So mm-hmm, it can be accessed that way. One thing that worries me is that school is where a lot of kids get their mental health support, and they're not in school right now. And when right, they return in some kind of a hybrid situation, they will likely not have as much time in school. Therefore, they not only won't have the time to access it, but eyeballs on these kids who might be showing problems will be reduced. You know, mm-hmm. coaches are often the people who see kids that are in trouble, or the teachers. Or another thing that I see is that parents think it's just typical teenage angst. I mean, what's normal in a pandemic? I mean, what is normal? So
nothing.
It's just a big kind of messy soup right now that we're all figuring out together.
Right. If somebody had a child that needed real medical assistance, how are these hospitals dealing with the safety rules in COVID? And
well, what McLean did early on, they did an absolutely remarkable job of just changing the way care was delivered. And it was all hands on deck 24/7. Just one of the many things that McLean Hospital does remarkably well.
It's amazing. I mean, in the 80s, I was a teenager. I was at boarding school. And, you know, I remember I had a friend taken away in a straitjacket. I had friends had all kinds of eating disorders. You know, this was sort of before antidepressants were so commonly given. But mm-hmm. I think then when I was a teenager, how fraught everything was. And now, you know, now that I have teens and now that we're in a pandemic, as a parent, I just go, I don't know what to do. Do I just put them all on Zoloft and hope for the best?
No. Well, I mean, some children might need that, but
yeah.
So we do know that anxiety and depression were already increasing in the teen population before the pandemic. And suicide among, I believe it's 12 to 19 year olds, is the second leading cause of death in the country after homicide. We're already worried.
Yeah.
And then you drop a pandemic on top of all of that, where everybody is scrambling. And we've got plenty of reason for concern. Now, I do want to talk about kids and resiliency, but first, mm-hmm. I've got a neighbor, a 13-year-old that I'm crazy about. Her name is Megan. And she and I had a really wonderful chat recently. She's really candid, super articulate. And she just described how really difficult this is for her. And I had chills talking to her. There are children in my life. But I really, really sat and talked with her about it and what she was feeling. And she said, you know, one day, so she's a self-described nerd. And last year she found her little group. We would have lunch together every day. And she said, I never realized how much my friends made every day better. And she said, we would share our food at lunch and we'd kind of tease each other and kind of push each other playfully. And we'd fight over each other's tater tots. And she said, then we're in school one day singing Disney songs. And the next day we're in quarantine. There was this visceral feeling of loss that as she described this.
Is it loss because of the isolation or because,
yes.
Yeah, and not having that kind of tactile relationship with her
yeah,
friends?
Yeah, she said it's just so different over Zoom.
Yeah.
She said, first, you know, you can't, I thought this was cute. She said, you can't see what they're wearing or whether they have new shoes. And we have our priorities straight. I'm glad. But she was just very thoughtful about how it's just not as free. And if she's on with her group of friends, you know, the muted mics or are the cameras on? And she said, and then we're not that good about planning that far ahead. So then we were just kind of seeing each other every 2 weeks because they live a little bit farther apart mm-hmm. from each other. That's a girl, Allie, that's got a mom and a dad and two younger siblings, and she's really close to them. And she describes her mom as her best friend. So she's struggling. And she cried when she talked with me, which I really was quite privileged that she shared that emotion with me and talking about, you know, not just the pandemic, but she said they had just lost a family friend. Then she talked about George Floyd. And then she talked about, you know, the world. She's 13. And she said, you know, what about my kids? What kind of world are they going to get? She said, it seems like 2020 every month is worse. And it's not going in the right direction. So I thought if a 13-year-old, she just turned 13, can articulate that, and she called it overwhelming. Mm-hmm. And I asked her, I said, what's the emotion under that? And, you know, I thought, I wonder if she even knows what that means. And she said, it's just overwhelming. I said, well, some kids are anxious, some kids are depressed, some kids are sad. And she said, I'm sad. But then mm-hmm. I cry, and my mom gives me a hug, and we talk, and then I'm okay. So she's got all of that support. I believe that she'll be okay. So no, not every kid should just automatically have, you know, Zoloft in their breakfast cereal every morning. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are things that parents can do in their exhaustion and strain that will really help make the difference in how kids respond. We don't know what the long-term effects will be. As I said, there will be, you know, billions of studies, but one factor definitely is family dynamics, mm-hmm. for good or bad, by the way.
We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back. Welcome back with more Go Ask Allie. Before we get into family dynamics, aren't you concerned about the millions of kids who, whether they had an ongoing, you know, problem with depression, or they were anxious, or they were fine, and suddenly their parents have lost their jobs? And so not only are they dealing with the pandemic and fear of getting sick, but now they have parents that are probably in some kind of a depression based on whatever has happened to them economically. I wonder, is there going to be a whole generation of depressed people because of the tidal wave of what's happened right now in this moment?
Well, I don't think that we want to automatically diagnose, you know, every child who's going through a really hard time. I did read recently that during the recession in the 90s, the number of kids who experienced mental health challenges really went up, and it was directly correlated with economic insecurity. And when I read that, I thought about my childhood. I grew up in a tiny town in Minnesota. My dad owned a little corner grocery store. A bigger market came to town, and my dad lost his business. My mother wasn't working at the time. She took her first job outside of the house at the age of 50, or we would have lost our home. And to this day, I can tell you that experience is very much with me, very, very much with me. And I remember conversations that my mother and I had about it, and it was terrifying. There are times in my life when I've gone through, you know, different shifts in my life where all of those emotions came back. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I've worked hard on that, and I'm resilient. We can't just automatically say that every kid that's going to really suffer through this will pay for a lifetime. They'll remember it.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's true. You say that about your upbringing. I had a horrible depression in my 20s where I couldn't even get out of bed. And you know, my whole family was terrified because I was this close to going to a McLean or a hospital. I couldn't eat. I couldn't do anything. And now when I look back at that time, I do feel resilient. There is something about going through an incredibly difficult period, whether it's personally, historically, it does make you stronger. So maybe I'm looking at it, the glass half empty instead of half full.
Well, what you just described, going through an adverse situation, there's actually a name for that. And Dr. Amy Gagliardi at McLean taught me post-traumatic growth. When we experience adversity, it's the actual struggle. And resilience is what helps us get through that struggle. And Amy talked about three ways that we can build and foster that resilience. And we can talk about those now if you want to.
I'd love to. I love post-traumatic growth instead of post-traumatic stress.
Had you ever heard of that?
No, but I really like it.
Isn't it great? And
yes.
It's a thing. It's
yeah.
a real thing. I mean, she sent me papers on it. I mean, I read about it, and I too was just so thrilled. And she even said that she's doing some of the things that we talked about that day. And I definitely am. So the first one is building connection. And so, for example, when I think about Megan, you know, she one of the things that she really misses is not being able to see her friends. But she has had opportunity to safely be around other kids. And parents have to work hard to find that. It might be a bike ride with a kid, a socially distanced trip to the park where mm-hmm. you sit on a blanket and have a picnic. But those are more structured sort of senses of connection. And, you know, as much as we didn't like social media before and Zoom and FaceTime and all of that, that's really helping right now. Of course, there are all kinds of boundaries that have to be put around that, but that is helping. Just for your listeners, I really want to share this because this was eye-opening to me. It doesn't have to be an intimate exchange. You don't even have to know the person. You don't even have to like the person. So I live by a beach. So I had been to the beach that morning, I believe, before this conversation with Amy. And it was high tide, so there wasn't a lot of room to walk. And so this woman that I didn't know was coming in my direction. So I stopped, she stopped, and we negotiated, okay, who's going to go where? And it took a second because we kind of went back and forth. And then I just paused and I said, you know, how are you doing? And we just had this exchange that was about 20 seconds long. And she said, that counts. That counts. So now when I go to the grocery store, which I don't go that often still, but I will now stop with the cashier and I will intentionally engage. I'm really mindful of connection because I know that it's helping us. Mm-hmm. The second is practicing gratitude. And Amy gave a really great example of this, a study that was done. She talked about a study in which people were over a week, it might have lasted longer, but in the first week, one group was asked to write down something they were grateful for. The second group was just to write down something they were really hassled about. And the third, just neutral, write whatever you want. And after 1 week, the people who wrote down things that they were grateful for showed a more positive mood. They were more likely to exercise, which, hello. Third was that they were more willing to do things for other people. And importantly, they slept better, regardless of the time of the day that they did it. She gave this as a very convincing piece of evidence around this practice of gratitude. And then the third one is doing for others. And I know that you and your family does a lot for others. So you may already know this, but this doing for others, even in teeny tiny doses, generates positive emotions and more so than receiving. And there are studies done on functional MRI machines mm-hmm. where they actually show that the reward center lights up more when you're giving than when you're receiving. And so we can practice just doing small things for people and it makes us feel good. There's this thing called, because it boosts endorphins as well, it's called the helper's high. And it's kind of like the runner's high. And so there's a real benefit, a real physiological benefit of doing these things. And I think we can help our kids by encouraging them to do something for somebody else. I mean, it's a distraction, but it also gives them a sense of purpose and meaning. One friend, Tanya, told me that she and her girls and possibly some other people in their neighborhood built or created lunch boxes for the food pantry at, mm-hmm. Through their church. One of the girls built a rainbow of balloons and put up a sign, thank you, frontline workers, that might see it by going by their house. I mean, just these little tiny things teach kids there are things that we can do and it's not just about us.
It's interesting you say that because, I mean, it is something that we try to implement with our kids. And in terms of the grateful, one of the things we try to instill with our two daughters is we try to have family dinner every night. And we certainly did during the pandemic. And we would go around the table and say, what are you grateful for? Particularly in a world where, you know, people are dying and suffering and losing their homes and their jobs. And I could see a tiny little change in them because instead of being, oh my God, this is so horrible, the pandemic, they had a moment where they go, well, I'm so grateful that I'm with my parents or whatever it was. So it took them, you know, certainly took them off themselves, which they were on their phones all about themselves for hours before that. But it got them out of their sort of self-involvement, I guess, and did make them look at the world in a much bigger way instead of, you know, this sucks for me, which I think is, you know, they teach it in religion. They teach it in so many sort of spiritual practices about being grateful and it works.
Exactly. There's just evidence that all of this, and you saw those tiny little bits in your girls. And when that's cumulative in a practice that continues, those are the kinds of things that I believe will get so many of our teens to the other side of this, who can then reflect back and be changed in a positive way. I mean, the uncertainty right now, we can't make promises to what it's going to look like. Megan, the 13-year-old, said, you know, what is this world going to look like? And, you know, that's not something we can answer. But what we can do right now is help give them purpose and meaning. Another friend of mine talks about the importance of helping kids build competencies, and that at a time when, of course, the teenage years are when you are building your social skills. Yeah. They're when you are figuring out who the heck you are. You're developing empathy. And importantly, and you know this for sure, they want that autonomy from their parents, but when they need you, they really, 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 really need you. And so right now.
Yeah, that is very difficult for a parent. I mean, I barely remember it as a teenager, but I'm getting a lot of wanting to be close, like cuddling with me and telling me everything. And then the next minute, like, I don't want to talk about it. Door slams. You know, I never.
Well, good. Congratulations. They're right on track.
Oh, my God.
Celebrate.
But how do they create autonomy in a pandemic?
Well,
I mean, how do I allow them to? Yeah.
Intentionally. So, you know, they are going to spend more time in their room. And, you know, we have to continually check in and just make sure that kids are okay. It's really all hands on deck. But I want to talk a little bit about building competency, because I think that as kids are struggling with that wanting autonomy, and, you know, some kids were able to get on, you know, public transportation for the first time, or they were out in the world in a way that they're not now, obviously. Friends have told me really interesting stories about things that their kids are doing that are giving them that sense of not adultness. Well, okay, let's use that. I don't even think that's a word. But like caring for their siblings, you know, in a way that they didn't before, because mom and dad are on Zoom and they're working 14 hours a day.
Right.
And so the kids have to step up. Another friend, her son was supposed to be in a school play and found out, I think, 3 days before they were going to perform, that it had been canceled because of the pandemic. I mean, suddenly, boom, quarantine. And he went to bed for 4 or 5 days. And his mom was obviously and correctly very concerned and would check in. And he said, "Mom, I just need time. I just need some downtime." And then she really did have to prod him after, I think, about the fifth day. And so he went out and he started to run. And then voila, he discovered cooking. And he just loves to cook.
Wow.
I'm jealous, right? I mean, I want him to come to my house.
Yeah.
And they're having what she described as restaurant quality meals every night. She said this came out of nowhere. So that's building competency, and the family's loving the food. And she said, "Oh my God, I'm driving. You can't believe where I'm going for these ingredients," because she wants to foster this in her kid. So there are ways. We have to stay really tuned into our kids. My clients are to a person depleted. And a friend of mine's a therapist. And she said that there are parents that are just saying, "Whatever, just go do it. I'm done. Do what you got to do." And we can't do that, because kids don't know. They're not malicious.
No.
They don't want to do something bad, but they're like, "Well, Jimmy seems fine. He doesn't seem sick. I think I'll go hang out with him." And suddenly there are 15 kids there. I mean, this happened, and you might have read about it, in Greenwich, Connecticut. They had parties. At one of the parties, the parents were serving alcohol. And guess what? Boom. As of my last reading, 88 people had become infected by this.
Right.
So we, you know, unfortunately, we can't let our guard down.
I mean, yeah, we can't let our guard down for a number of reasons. But I will say too that I've noticed, certainly with my friends, I didn't realize how many things our children just need to learn in general. I have a friend, and she and her husband both work. They're on Zoom calls all day. And, you know, to their youngest 12-year-old said, "You know, you're got to clean the toilets. I'm going to buy you a brush. You're going to clean the toilets. Like, you got to do the laundry. Like, you got to pitch in." And we started implementing that a little bit in our house. And I realized this is a good thing. They should know
exactly
how to do all this stuff. I can't believe I've been doing all this stuff for them, you know. And then there became kind of a sense of community of like, these are the chores. These are, we all live together. We all need to kind of help out. And that was certainly helpful. It also kept them busy for a little while. But I think what's happening now is things are opening up a little bit, certainly for us in New York. And so the parents are kind of going, "Well, that was an exhausting few months. Yeah, now go do whatever you want." And that makes me very, very nervous, certainly for, you know, my eldest teen who wants to go out and socialize. I think there's a majority of parents that are tired and are allowing the teens to kind of you know, go out, and this is not on any from any statistic, but I would assume these teens, some of them are just raring to get out there. They've been cooped up with their parents for months, you know, so it's a little bit like letting the greyhounds out of the gate. So how do you speak to parents when they say, I'm exhausted?
Well, you can't put the baby back. It's your job. That's how I say it. Mm-hmm. You know, and did we come through all of this to then just say, okay, let the greyhounds out? No. Kids want to do the right thing. I think we need to recognize that. They want to do the right thing. It's our job to help them understand what that is. And if you create concrete examples for them, they're much more likely to take it into their still developing brain.
So they should. So, for example, should a parent say, you know, I just read about what happened in Greenwich, Connecticut. Let me tell you, you know, this would happen and consequently grandparents were sick. I mean, should people actually pull real stories as learning tools?
Absolutely. I mean, before the pandemic, I always said that about whether it's sex or alcohol or other drugs, the media is full of real life stories. And mm-hmm. so absolutely, because the more concrete and real that we make it, the more likely they are to stand up to their civic duty and try to do their part. I mean, some kids are going to be really good about that. Some are going to be very laissez-faire and get by with it. And others will be laissez-faire and they will regret it because someone that they love will get sick because mm-hmm. of their behaviors. I mean, it's happening. It's as easy to predict as the sun coming up tomorrow.
Yeah. Yeah. Now a quick word from our sponsors. Welcome back to Go Ask Allie. Let's get back to the discussion. So you talked earlier about growth from adversity. So I want to talk about positive things because, again, this is coming off of parents being exhausted. How do I instill that sense to my kids and other parents instill to theirs, that sense of you can grow from this? That we go forward as opposed to locking ourselves in our rooms and pulling down the shades.
Right. Well, first of all, just being present. Kids need someone that they can bump off of that they really trust. You know, it's easy for me to say, but I know how hard this is because all of the people that I know and my clients are working, you know, around the clock. I mean, they get up at the crack of dawn to work before all hell breaks loose in the household. And I'm not saying that every house is dealing with stuff, but, you know, you combine quarantine with raging hormones and really long work schedules, and you got something going on there. And so listen, John Reed, the former CEO of Citibank, I talked with him about, I don't know how many years ago, but I've never forgotten what he said. I was talking with him about because I work with leaders primarily now. And I said, you know, what do you think is the key quality of an effective leader? And he said, listening. And he said, when I say listen, I mean, listen with both ears and with your eyes and not think about the next thing you're going to say. Because we know kids are intuitive. They can tell when we are really, really listening. And so to listen and put down the phone, really engage. That's what empathy is really understanding where somebody's coming from. A friend's kid was, you know, in tears over something. And she said, this isn't worth crying about. And the daughter said, I don't need you to fix it. I just need you to listen.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was worth crying about because the kid was crying.
I hear that from my kids too. Now I've given myself permission when I'm with my girls to say, yeah, I'm scared too. I don't know. But the parent in me wants to fix it. And the parent in me was like, oh, I'm sure you're going to have prom this spring. Oh, no doubt school opens soon. You know, because that's instinctual for me to try to fix it for them. I think it's scary to say to the kids, I don't know what's going to happen. I have no idea. I'm terrified. You're like, oh my God, am I giving them a solid base?
No, but it's, yes, you are, because that's honest. Mm-hmm. And we all have emotions. Emotions are good. It's how we talk about them. I mean, if you say, I'm not scared, well, I mean, first of all, your girls have access to the news. They know what's going on and they're not going to believe you. And so you're going to lose trust. And then just subconsciously, they're going to think mom's just trying to make me feel better. I think it's how we talk about them. I mean, if we are angry and we get really angry and throw a pot across the room, you know, that's not modeling how we deal with these very real emotions. We can say, I am so angry about this. I mean, we can modulate our own emotions and then model to them how to handle these. But in talking about our fear and our frustrations and even how exhausted we find everything is just really honest. And they absorb much more by watching us than the advice we give them. And you know that.
Mm-hmm, yes. It's not what we say. It's what we do, actually. We talked about what Amy said, helpful, positive things. So I want to just quickly go over them again. It's connection. So go on a bike ride with somebody. In my case, find a friend who will go clamming with me. Safe in a pandemic, one-on-one things. So I can say to my daughters, why don't you ask a friend if you want to go to the beach and social distance at the beach? Or like exactly. You said, have a picnic.
But Allie, I just want to say it doesn't have to be like a 2-hour thing. You know, if the mailman comes or the UPS guy drops something now at the end of my walk, you know, I'll yell out and I'll say, hey, thanks so much. And, you know, we can have a 20-second thing. I don't even know his name. Amy says that counts as connection.
Okay, right. So that's acts of kindness, basically, especially right now when people are needing it. And the gratefulness, what are you grateful for? And the third is?
Is doing for others.
Doing for
others.
Even
those little mini tiny things. It can be just the smallest thing and it counts.
Great. I mean, yeah. So you don't have to bake banana bread for everybody in the state, but you can say hi to your UPS guy. Yes, I know. And are there any, you know, these are such simple, but helpful, positive things. Are there any things that we should be looking at or looking for with our teens in terms of mental health that should be warning signs?
Yeah. What we want to look for is when they have more bad days than good, when their sleeping patterns shift and they're not curious or interested in doing the things that they were interested in doing before, it's time to check in. Ask your pediatrician, just staying on top of it. Super important because we know that there are going to be young people who really need professional help at the end of this. That's just a given. I've written a series of booklets, Words Can Work When Talking About Depression, Words Can Work When Talking About Alcohol, Words Can Work When Talking About Drugs. And parents in every one of those situations, really, regardless of what the public or mental health challenge was, that their kid was experiencing, I had parents tell me, I just thought it was typical teenage angst. So now when we're so distracted and we're tired and we're stressed, we have to dig much deeper, I think, to make sure that we're on top of what normal is for our kid and when they vary from that. A friend of mine, Laura, has 3 teens, and she said that she has to remind herself every single day that she has to be the parent. Because she said, sometimes I want to be 10. I'm just, you know, she just wants to suck her thumb and pull the blanket up. But she has to remind herself every day that she has to do this now. Because in the long run, it's going to really help her kids come through this much stronger and more productive, happier, healthier. And we can do it. You know, it will make a difference.
I know. I'm trying. And then I do want to say, are there things particularly going on now that would trigger a depression or trigger real height in anxiety? Mm-hmm. What is a safe dialogue to have with your teen about any sort of mental health issues? Can you speak
this
to
doesn't,
that?
Brian Johnson, who's a friend of mine, he's an addiction specialist, told me recently that interestingly, many young people, teens are buying drugs in the hallways at school. You know, essentially you can swing a cat in a hallway at school and hit someone who's got drugs in their pocket for sale, and all kinds of drugs, whether they're Adderall for ADHD or OxyContin and marijuana. I mean, you can buy this stuff in the schools. Parents definitely now that kids are going to be going back to some kind of school schedule, hybrid in school thing, need to be talking with their kids because we are in this heightened time of anxiety and uncertainty. And we know that adults and kids both self-medicate. Mm-hmm. And so it's important that parents have these conversations and help role play. How would, you know, what would you do? Do you know any of your friends that are using drugs? You know, what are your dreams and aspirations? What do you want to accomplish? And let me help you understand that that's much more likely to happen if you don't get engaged in drugs.
So, Jean, you have, I read about this before we spoke, Words Can Work, which are books about how parents can speak to the teenagers, their kids, about many different subjects. So tell me about these, because I think these will be so helpful for parents.
So prior to being an executive coach, I produced multimedia about kids and the public and mental health challenges that they face growing up. And I did that for a long time. So we have a library of multimedia. And I was, when I was producing a video called Alcohol True Stories that Matt Damon hosted, that parents would say, I'd say, do you talk to your kids about alcohol? And they came up with these, so many parents said, I don't know what to say. And literally some people said, give me the words. So I was really fortunate to work with a number of experts from McLean Hospital, from Mass General, from my friend Brian Johnson, who's now at SUNY in Syracuse, on this set of booklets. So they're available on e-booklets. Words Can Work When Talking About Alcohol, Words Can Work When Talking About Drugs, Words Can Work When Talking About Depression. And our website, blakeworks.com, you can find this under a blog that I wrote recently about kids and their mental health.
That's fantastic. One of the biggest hurdles for parents is finding the words and how to talk to kids about any of these things.
Yeah, and so many parents are afraid that, well, if I talk about it, they'll do it. Well, guess what? They're already doing it. They're already thinking about it. And so I think giving them context.
Yeah.
And helping them role play how they can negotiate out of situations, because we know that kids are under peer pressure to do all of this stuff. And it's a big gift that we can give our kids to meet them where they are and help them find their way out of it.
Yeah, safely. I mean, I've found that by talking about it, I've even given them a few hints. Like if you feel like you're going to be judged at a party because you don't drink, have a cup of ginger ale. They don't know what it is. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
Like there's ways of kind of going around peer pressure and stuff. And, you know, these are conversations I never would have had with them had I not sat down and said, look, this is not a lecture. You know, I'm not saying just say no to drugs. I want to have a real conversation with you about them, what you're thinking, what you're feeling, how scary they are. And that's helped. But I do know that there have been times I've been tongue-tied about how to broach a subject. Thank you so much, Jean Blake. Thank you for helping me and so many parents through this. And I may pull you back on my podcast again in a few months to see how we're doing.
I hope so. It's
yeah.
Just a pleasure. Thank you for what you're doing, making a difference in people's lives. Thank you.
Thank you. Three positive things we can implement in our lives: connection, gratitude, acts of kindness. Thank you for listening to Go Ask Allie. Remember to subscribe to Go Ask Allie and follow me on my social media, Twitter at Allie E. Wentworth and Instagram, The Real Allie Wentworth. Go Ask Allie is a production of Shondaland Audio in partnership with iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from Shondaland Audio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.